three sheets that need to be, that were just added in by the administration, that's why they're not in the original. There's the June 1st pass out of the proposed bill. The changes, the only changes made from the time that we passed it out previously are the one identified by amendments starting June 1st. Those are the specific changes that were made by various people. Now, in addition to that, the administration came in 10 minutes ago with another proposed change, which is this pass out, that starts proposed amendments to, by adding the new section, to read section blank, section 30, chapter 82, blah, blah, blah. Now, also there's a letter of intent from Senator Josephson with regard to the repertory theater proposal. And those are the three things that would have to be approved. And if you have any questions, any of the new sections that are added, we can answer them with us, the staff, and everybody else. About five or six of these are administration requests where they've had problems with specific ones, it's word changes, and the rest are from individual legislators. Do you want more time, or do you want me to move? Go ahead.
I'd like to move on this if the committee's ready.
Okay, move for adoption of the June 2nd version that incorporates the governor's two amendments and the letter of intent with individual recommendations. Put it out for individual recommendations.
All in favor of the motion?
And the proposed amendment.
Yeah.
Motion carries. Any discussion on 309? No one signed up to testify. Do we have any other motion?
Put out the individual recommendations.
Motion for the committee to put the bill out on individual recommendations. All in favor? 309 is approved again. Take up at this time, please substitute the House Bill 103, establishing Department of Corrections and transferring functions from the Health and Social Services Department. Is there anyone here from the department to testify?
Roger Endo. I'm director of the Division of Corrections. I'll make a few comments, try to keep them brief. I'm very concerned about this bill. It's a bill that I think that the 650 or so correctional employees around the state are watching very carefully. I think we do have a very serious morale problem right now, and I know they'd be encouraged by your assistance. In essence, the system is overcrowded and the staff is overworked. We have, as I suggested, a morale problem. These folks were encouraged, I think, by a new administration, a new legislature, and an executive order creating a department. That action has not yet been completed, so I hope that we can help expedite that from this point forward. We're facing a daily and continuing crisis in overcrowding. We have roughly 1,500 prisoners in space for 1,100. We have 200 prisoners outside the state of Alaska in the Federal Bureau of Prison System, and that's now the limit. So that every prisoner now that we wish to send outside to our outside prison system, it means that we must return somebody for each person we send out. We have opened a brand new institution in February since I took office at Cook Inlet facility in Anchorage. That facility was built to hold 180 prisoners. It today has 220, and that number is growing. We are double bunking that institution as quickly as we can do so. We have escapes, which I'm sure you're all aware of, most of those escapes are related to outmoded buildings not designed or built by corrections. We need to get out of those facilities as quickly as possible. We're doing our best to hold them together, but it's very difficult. Will Condon reported in the November report to the governor that the correctional system was receiving 17 more prisoners a month than it was releasing. We are now receiving approximately 30 prisoners more a month than we are releasing. Conservatively, we will be acquiring 300 new beds per year after year from now on in the state of Alaska if this same level of incoming prisoners continues. I doubt seriously that anyone wishes to fund 300 new beds every year from now on. We must bring about some reforms. Some of those reforms I can control, some of them I have very little control over. Some of the reforms that I have in mind, with a new department, we will have a new management structure, which will be regionalized and decentralized. The regional managers will be responsible for all correctional activities within that region. These regional managers will report to the commissioner's office. All correctional facilities, functions, programs within a region will be managed by that one manager. We will have a program manager, an administrative manager, and an operations manager. So a very small nuclear staff directly connected to the commissioner's office will, in fact, manage the correctional system. We will be stressing, we already have begun work on inmate work programs. It's my strong belief that the inmate population is able-bodied for the most part and can work 8 to 5, similar to most people in free society. Other programs, education, rehabilitation, arts, crafts, recreation, and so on can take place after hours, after the workday. We can pay these people at least a token salary of some sort. In turn, they can assist with room and board, pay for incidentals, and perhaps contribute to their own families who are out in free society. The Cleary case is coming up in January. That is now a comprehensive correctional case. The court has expanded the case from 6 original institutions to now encompass the entire correctional system. I'm going to be arguing in January along with the staff and support people that we do not have an unconstitutional system in the state of Alaska. We do have one that's overcrowded. That overcrowding can be relieved very shortly. I'm going to be setting up a restitution component. This has been done in other states and locations, and there are all kinds of people who can verify that inmates are capable of returning several millions of dollars to the victims and or the state. So there are several things that can be done. I'm sorry, there's a question.
Yeah, Roger, what's the difference between the House Judiciary version and the proposed Senate Judiciary and the bills before us?
I think the major issue, major difference is the juvenile issue. The House wanted the juveniles to transfer over to the new Department of Corrections. The Senate apparently did not wish the juveniles to transfer over.
Do we have a section of analysis of either one of those? Anybody have them?
I have one in my packet.
I don't have one. Could you have a make a comment for me?
On that subject, is the administration now satisfied with the Senate Judiciary version of the bill?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. While I have you here, Roger, let me ask you a question. I received a letter from, this is somewhat related, but not, if the chairman is not specifically on the bill, but I have a letter from Mr. Stern, who represents the petitioners in the Cleary matter, if I understand it. And if I recall his letter correctly, it was that he opposes the legislation we've been working on for maximum security facilities, saying that that you have adequate bed space and maximum security now. Could you comment on that? He thinks that it's this has struck me as unexpected because, as I understand it, he's been an advocate for more expenditures, but he says that it isn't necessary to have more capital expenditures in the maximum security segment, population segment.
Yes, another member of the legislature shared a copy of that letter with me, and I was amazed, shocked even, that Mr. Yes. Stearns would take that step. We do not have a maximum security facility in this state. What he's referring to in his letter is a Cook Inlet pretrial facility, which is very secure, but it is not for people serving 10, 20, 30, or life sentences. There is no way that the state of Alaska could continue to function without a maximum security prison. We must have one, and I think the Task Force on Corrections pointed that out very clearly. It was the unanimous opinion of judges, law enforcement officials, correctional people, and the community from Barrow to Ketchikan that it's time in Alaska to build such a facility.
Have you had an opportunity to consider correspondence from Mr. Murdings and his group concerning the old Isbell campsite?
Yes, I have. That proposition that's been presented to us is an extremely expensive one. It would cost roughly $9.8 million a year to house 300 prisoners in a facility known previously as Isbell Camp. There are other costs. That's just the head cost. There are other costs in addition to that. So I would guess that we're talking about a $10 to $10.5 million operation a year to take care of 300, a minimal guarantee of 300 prisoners. That's very expensive.
Mr. Chairman?
There was a proposed amendment by Senator Petula. Could you comment on that? I just gave you a copy.
Yes, thank you, Senator. This is a very important amendment, I think, which would help corrections immeasurably. It would permit the use of capital money for lease or lease purchase of correctional facilities. What that means is that in lean times or in times when large capital outlays for correctional construction are not feasible or not likely, that much smaller amounts of money can be set aside to be used for the same purposes. In fact, my staff and I have learned in talking to several different corporations that we can take relatively small amounts of money and commence construction on needed necessary facilities right away simply by lease. Long-term lease, short-term lease, lease with options to buy. It gets us the space that we need very quickly at, I think a tremendous savings in terms of time and cost, at least upfront kinds of costs. The problem is one that I think everyone realizes is there. It's not just the problem for whoever's heading up the Division of Corrections this year. It's a problem for the legislature, for the executive and judicial branches. I'll be talking to the state judiciary next Tuesday in Fairbanks. I have 2 hours on their agenda, and I plan to tell them that they are, remind them that they are partners in this criminal justice system, and we have to work together to resolve some of these problems. I'm hopeful that will come about. If we do not resolve these problems, I'm concerned, and I suppose I sound like a bit of an alarmist, but it is quite clear that we can face very serious difficulties when we go to trial next January. The Senate, I know, helped us, attempted to do what we had asked in terms of our budget. There were some minor cuts made, but those minor cuts are going to have major impacts. For example, one of the pieces that I think is extremely important is this restitution person that I would be adding to the staff. That one and two individuals, actually, can return millions of dollars to the state coffers if we can just fund it. Wildwood, which we've just acquired in a lease last Friday, will give us temporary help in bed space, but I have 10 months funding to operate it. Even though you only will be giving me 10 months operation, I've got people down there now. I'm going to open it now. I don't know what I'll do when the 10 months money runs out, but I'm going to do it anyway because I don't have any choice.
What was your statutory authority for Wildwood absent the passage of the Curtula Amendment?
Statutory authority, I'm sorry.
Well, you say you leased the Wildwood facility and the...
Yes, the Department of Administration has authority to lease buildings for state purposes, and they did that for us.
Oh, they did that for you?
Yes.
And this amendment would allow you to do it directly?
That's correct. We have a great deal of difficulty in the construction building leasing area because we're totally dependent on two other departments, either DOTPF for new construction or administration for lease or lease purchase.
Well, what would be the role of the legislature in oversight as to the choice of lease purchase or some other mode of acquiring property? I mean, would you be coming back to us in each instance for approval, or would that be spelled out in appropriations, or would you have some authority to do that on your own under this amendment?
The intent here is merely to have the opportunity to utilize capital improvement money when it's low in amount, to stretch those dollars as far as we can to acquire necessary space. As far as legislative interaction, I see no problem there whatsoever. The intent here is to try to save you and I and everyone else a lot of time and trouble. You see, excuse me if I sound facetious, but the problems that we're experiencing occur week after week after week, month after month after month. I cannot solve all of these problems for the months that the legislature is in session or for those months where you consider specific bills. The problems are ongoing, and I've got to have some kind of latitude to address those problems. And I would certainly expect that if I overstep the bounds or do something that's inappropriate, I would expect to hear from you. But in a realistic sense, it seems to me that the wisest way to approach some of these problems are ongoing consultations with you, so that you know precisely what we're doing. I was called yesterday by a reporter from the media and talked for about 20 minutes. And the reporter went on and on and on about escapes and what we could do to prevent them and will these things continue? Will public safety be jeopardized and so on? I tried to explain that we'll do our best to control the situation, but in fact we have more felons, more serious types of crimes, who have committed more serious types of crimes, going into facilities that were not designed to hold these kinds of prisoners. The Third Avenue Institution in Anchorage, the Sixth Avenue Institution in Ridgeview, none of those were designed or built by corrections. They are facilities that are outmoded. We're patching them together with spit and baling wire, trying to hold it together. It will not last. We must have replacement facilities.
What is the total cost that you have presently projected for replacement costs? How many million did you have?
Well, our capital request was for $32 million. However, that's difficult to explain. $6 million of that, for example, is for renovation and repair, boilers and roofs and so on in our existing facilities. There's $6 million for a Nome correctional facility, which would replace the territorial jail we're now using. There's $11.7 million for South Central correctional facilities, part of which I would hope to be able to use to make renovations to Wildwood, part of which I would like to use for construction of a new replacement facility in Anchorage to get us out of three institutions we're now using. The other thing that I'd like to share with you is that as a result of our work in talking to various corporations, we are now convinced that we can build a 400-bed maximum security facility for half the cost that was previously estimated by DOTPF. We can also build a 250-bed replacement facility in Anchorage for half the cost previously estimated. And we can do both of those with lease or lease purchase, which means that for very small amounts of money to start with, we can get into those facilities. Using private money,
That is, the private sector will build these facilities. We agree through a lease to pay them X dollars a year until it's finally ours. So there's tremendous advantages in terms of construction techniques, financial packages, financial alternatives which are available, and time. And right now, time and money are both very important to us. Money has already been previously allocated for the replacement facility in Bethel. We'll have a 100-bed facility going up in Bethel. It is going up in Bethel.
Senator?
What accounts for that enormous cost differential? Why can you, on a lease purchase basis, get a facility for half the cost as if you went out to bed?
It's not because of the lease purchase. That's just a better arrangement to get these things going. It's because of the new construction techniques that are being used by these corporations. Modular kinds of construction by one company that we've talked to. Another one has designed what is known as a prototype institution. That's the 400-bed maximum security prison. It's a pre-designed facility which can be built anywhere in the United States. Hence, we save millions of dollars on that kind of a facility with only minor modifications for local climate or seismic conditions. We can have the same facility that could be built in Arkansas or Texas or Michigan or anywhere else. So there's tremendous cost savings. Also, it's been designed by Dr. Alan Ault, who has been a correctional commissioner in three different states, the head of the National Institute of Corrections, and an academician. The design is extremely efficient. It eliminates all kinds of electronic hardware and uses people instead of electronics, which is very expensive. So there are all kinds of cost-saving factors that go into these new designs. So the design is there, the financial packages are there. What we don't have are the resources to go ahead.
Any further questions? Do you have anything further, Roger?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to propose the amendment to the Senate version to incorporate into a Finance Committee substitute. I would move and ask unanimous consent.
Motion for the committee to include the amendment. Mr. Curtula, all in favor?
And next motion would be to zero out both fiscal notes. They're already in the budget. And move it out of committee to recommend.
For the committee to zero out the fiscal notes, move it out individual recommendations. All in favor? Carried. Next item we have up is Senate Bill 55.
Mr. Chairman, I've handed out a memo to which I attached two versions of Senate Bill 55 to propose committee to the essence. Version one is based on Senator Mulcahy's ideas of a positive action by the legislature. Version two follows Senator Ray's ideas and is based on the May 20 version submitted by the Attorney General's office, which was also handed out today, the memo from the AG. Memo from the AG notes that the proposed substitute for CSSB 55 does not raise the legal concerns identified in our letter of May 1883. This applies to both versions 1 and 2. They are described in my June 2 memo. I personally have no particular preference between the two. The Deputy Commissioner of Administration, Elna Andrews, I believe, has signed up to testify.
Mr. Chairman, Vic, can you tell us just verbally what the difference is? Explain them.
The differences between the original SB 55 that came into the committee and the both substitutes are that the Department of Administration will submit the monetary terms only after the agreement has been entered into, rather than submitting a draft agreement as judiciary proposed.
Uh-huh.
Both of them provide that legislative action taken by resolution is by the legislature is a non-binding advisory expression of legislative intent. Both CSs change the period of time in which a legislature can act from 30 to 60 days. Both contain a provision enabling the parties to resume negotiations if the monetary terms are not supported by the legislature. Then version one requires an approval by concurrent resolution to express that the monetary terms of agreement are acceptable to the legislature, whereas version two, the monetary terms will be considered acceptable to the legislature unless a concurrent resolution is enacted by the legislature.
So, just kind of, I might pursue that a little bit. Then, in my understanding, Senator, is that version two is a negative action, or we take no action, and by taking no action, we then approve.
Right, that is correct.
But it's non-binding.
They're both non-binding, but as was pointed out last time, by not taking action, you leave yourself, I mean, if you take version two, you leave yourself open to somebody simply stalling and running the clock out.
Oh. Or?
You don't want to.
If you take version, isn't it the reverse? If you take version two, nobody can. If there's no action, then the monetary terms would be
right.
And then it passes. If you take version one, somebody could stall.
They could stall.
And
Either way. Right. Version two, the monetary terms of the agreement will be considered acceptable to the legislature unless a resolution is passed.
So, Senator Frank.
Just briefly before we get off on this and debating it, I'd like to thank Senator Fisher for preparing this analysis of the two versions. It's super, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Mulcahy?
Well, then, I mean, I'm catching up on this version two. Version two, then, it is a case of if the legislature doesn't do anything, then it's implied that we approve the agreement, and then it would also be, even though it's supposedly non-binding, it's been implied that we're going to fund it.
So I would say one, then there's a moral obligation.
So by not taking any positive action, just by letting the issue sit on the table, we're implying that we go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
In version one, then, we would have to take if there was an agreement there, and we concurred with that agreement, we would take some positive action to say the legislature does concur with what the administration has done, or the legislature would say that we don't concur and go back to the bargaining table.
Right. In version one, non-action, in effect, means the legislature does not take on any kind of a moral obligation. In effect, it's a rejection of a monetary term, not a legal rejection, but an implied rejection.
But under either of them, it doesn't make any difference anyway.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe Senator Ray's initial intent was simply to get the legislature involved in this kind of a non-binding advisory fashion before the legislature had to
approve
an agreement before it.
Okay, if you do that, then they're not obligated to go back and renegotiate, and the same arguments will come up now. It means nothing. We've got a proposal, we've got a contract, and we're not going to change it until you fund it. That's the type of attitude they'll have. It's identical to what we have presently.
I thought Senator Ray, we just called him to bring him up. I thought his whole idea, correct me if I'm wrong, was to get us into the act early so that if we didn't approve the monetary terms, there wouldn't be an obligation down the road if they continued with it. If you chose not to fund it, that would be...
That would be okay.
Right.
Now, we have Terry Kramer, the Blue Ribbon Commission, signed up to testify. Terry, did you want to testify on this? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Terry Kramer, the Administrative Assistant to the Blue Ribbon Commission. I've seen both versions of Senate Bill 55, and as you might expect, the Blue Ribbon Commission original proposal was more in line with version 2, the one which says that unless the legislature acts, it will be assumed that the agreements are acceptable. What the commission intended to do in sponsoring the bill initially was to take up the issue of collective bargaining agreements early in the session so that the parties involved would have a chance to respond to whatever the legislature did. The parties would have the choice of negotiating if the legislature chose to reject the contract. I'm not sure that you can require them to negotiate, but I just don't know that question. Check with you in general. I think the problem with the first version is that if you do have inaction, it doesn't tell the parties anything. And it leaves them in limbo again, not knowing whether the legislature just ran into a time problem of some sort, or whether in fact there were terms which need to be looked at again and some action taken to respond to the legislature's concerns. I think version 2 encourages the legislature to make its concerns known, and therefore encourages a communication between the legislature, the administration, and the unions and associations involved.
Well, yes, as I understand it, one of Senator Ray's purposes was to avoid letting everybody twist in the wind for a whole version or longer here, and at least version 2 would have the virtue, even though it's non-binding, of at least from a moral point of view, saying the legislature had a chance, disapproved, and didn't. And therefore, it was an argument for funding the monetary agreement. That's
about
what
this
is
about.
Mm-hmm.
Senator?
Did you say you had an attorney general? I guess the thing that probably bothers me most at this point in time is, would we have a, even with the negative action, would we have a, and even though it's spells out that it's supposed to be advisory and doesn't, is non-binding, would we have an implied liability there for funding further on down the trail, or a contingent liability, whatever you want to call it, that then could get us into court in the case that we didn't fund it? Or would we end up in court anyway?
Mr. Chairman, all I can do is rely on the AG's memo of May 20, which says that this version does not raise the legal concerns identified in our letter of May 18, which indicated a concern then about, in effect, acting by inaction when positive legislation was required, whereas their opinion now appears to be that the language changes would take care of that.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that I always get a little gun shy on is when you get a note from somebody that says that if I don't hear from you by next Thursday, I can have your house, your car, your airplane, your wife, your kids. And I don't think the legislature should be placed in that position either, that because of the inability to act or react, that something is assumed. And I hope we don't get into that.
The rubber stamp approach, right? Are we doing this in either one of these bills?
Mr. Chairman, I suggest we get Elna Andrews here, and maybe we can discuss this with her since she's involved in negotiating this contract.
Is she a passenger? Yes. Yeah.
I'm Eleanor Andrews, Deputy Commissioner of Administration for Personnel Management. I've reviewed drafts 1 and 2 of the Senate Finance Committee substitute for 215. And the Department of Administration supported the original intent of SB 55, which was to enhance the collective bargaining process and allow some indication from the legislature what they were going to do after agreements were negotiated. I don't really have a difficulty in versions 1 or 2 because they allow for the regular negotiation process to take place where the parties reach agreement and ratify agreement. It provides a time limit for Department of Administration to get the agreement to the legislature in a timely manner, either during the session or within the first 10 days after the next session convenes. I don't believe that there are the legal problems with this bill because the legislature is not bound to do something. You're advising the parties of whether you think the monetary terms are acceptable, and they have the option of going back to the table or holding out. The three court cases that I'm aware of where the unions went to court and either sued the legislature and the administration, the court has always said that it is the legislature's authority to appropriate. And so this bill is not requiring you to appropriate, and I don't think that expressing an intent by concurrent resolution is going to bind you in that manner, so I don't have those legal problems with this
substitute.
I have a problem with the, I suppose, the potential definition of monetary terms, because there are a lot of portions of an agreement, of a negotiated agreement that don't come to the legislature that I'm just beginning to learn about. Extra vacation time, time off on your birthdays, you get first preference for other jobs. There's a tremendous amount of things that we never even see that technically, I suppose you could say that they're monetary eventually because they do cost the state something, but we never do see them. All we see is the percentage increase on a specific salary. And I'd like to see the whole package.
I don't believe that this administration has any difficulty with that. My understanding has been that prior process was that you would get the actual wages. For example, in the recently negotiated APEA General Government Unit Agreement, they took an additional holiday in lieu of pay. I believe that that is a monetary term of an agreement. Now, certain administrative things that you can't really cost out, like promotional procedures, I don't think that those are the kinds of things that the 2340 talks to as far as monetary terms. But, you know, when we negotiate it, we cost out certain facets of the agreement, and holidays in lieu of or increased leave are monetary terms, and I believe that those things should be brought before you for approval. Just apparently the legislature never asked before and the administration never provided, but we don't have any
difficulty. Before this bill does go on, I'd like to see some definition of what monetary terms mean so that there's no question as to what we're talking about and have it not depend upon the interpretation of the particular.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we could come up with that. I'm not prepared to give you that universe at this hearing, but I believe.
Well, even if it goes out this morning, I want it for the floor.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to pursue it with Eleanor and bring it back to the committee, unless you want to move it to rules, and then I'll provide it to rules.
Whatever is the pleasure of the committee.
I don't want to hold it up because of that particular one, but I think it's extremely important because it's amazing how much it's costing the state in addition to just, say, a 5% salary increase for all of these other benefits.
Yes, it's really not that difficult to tell because we do have interest arbitration for our public safety unit. And in those interest arbitrations, the arbitrator is presented with the contractual language, the right kinds of things, and the monetary terms, and the arbitrator is authorized to select from item by proposal, item by item. So I think that we can come up with a list of what is traditionally known as monetary terms in a pretty short fashion.
But isn't it true that the monetary terms might be different depending on which unit you're bargaining with?
Oh, certainly, yes.
Like the people in the ferry system, free rides for families back and forth, and free movement of automobiles, and
that's
whereas
true.
If you're dealing with another element, there isn't that sort of a benefit considered.
What's the problem with submitting the entire negotiated agreement?
Well, the current law doesn't provide for the legislature to approve anything but the monetary terms. The administration is charged with the responsibility of negotiating and day-to-day contract administration, and what's reserved for the legislature is appropriating the money to support those agreements.
Okay, the entire agreement that's changed into monetary terms, because every one of those items that Senator Bennett mentioned does have a monetary cost to the state. Free ride for your families or free transportation of your car does have a monetary dollar value to it. And somehow to write it so that all of those are submitted in a manner whereby we can look at it in terms of the dollar amount.
I think, Jacket, that what we need to do is make a list of what is traditionally considered monetary terms. And then for each contract that comes before you for appropriation, that we list them by contract. Now, I don't really have any authority about how these contracts are given to you as far as what kind of bill, if it's going to be separately just the pay bill or if it's going to be attached to other things, but they can certainly be specifically identified.
I think that's very, very important. The first time I ran into this was about 5 years ago with the negotiated salaries for the community college teachers at Anchorage. And in there, in addition to the costs, the regular salary increases, they had things like taking care of their children for daycare, free classes for the spouse, and they're all additional costs, and yet we had no control over those specific ones. And I think it's very necessary for the legislature and the public to see those costs.
Mr. Chairman, I still would like someone to tell me if these bills will take the stigma of the rubber stamp away. Will there be some significant impact if we pass these bills in the legislature's role in this process?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's any impact except what I referred to before, that is, it sets a timeline for the administration to send over the package. And it gives us a timeline to respond, as a, at least as a moral obligation, to notify the parties if there's a problem. Or it's like, you know, forever hold your peace. But we still can come back, technically, and not appropriate the funds, no matter what happens under this scenario.
Well, but what the folks are saying, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman, the folks are saying, or the employees out there are saying, is that the administration and the bargaining units negotiated in good faith, and they have an agreement. And why does in the House not fund their salary increase? You know, why, what, we've done this in good faith, we've been promised this amount, we've come to the table, how can you do this? And so I think the purpose of this, if I'm not mistaken, was to somehow or another change that scenario around so that we were participating, and I'm just wondering.
Mr. Chairman, I personally, this doesn't answer your question, but expressing an opinion, but I personally wouldn't want the legislative branch, and I don't think we should be involved in the negotiation, because I think that's an executive function. So I don't think there is any way to answer that argument except to say that they propose and we dispose, and if we think it's too rich, we won't provide the money, and that's going to be our right. But at least this gives them an expression, and in a way encourages us to give an early expression of our view. What often does happen is, I think, that inadvertently or the matter goes on for a long time, and then you have the problem that if you don't fund it, people have made their expectations and plans, assuming the contract would be approved, or ultimately, or they would get their money, and you can't unwind it because so much time has gone by. Am I right in that, Eleanor?
Yes, we've had the contracts negotiated since the second week in December. Ratified in January and came over to the legislature, and it's very difficult administratively to plan, to budget, to know what your work programs are going to be. And the longer it goes on, the more difficult it is to manage.
Senator Fisher?
I do see the advantage of the approach of this bill. and that in effect the legislature is given a chance to say, short of not appropriating funds, to say state revenues are going down, the package is too expensive, go back and bring us a package that's 50% lower than what you propose. And that's much better than the position that we're in now, where we fund it, or the chairman of House Finance tells them you either fire a bunch of people to pay the cost, or you don't get it.
Senator McKay.
Well, to add to this discussion, I strongly support Senator Sackett's proposal to add language or add definition, whether they're fringe benefits like carrying your car, or I don't know where you put your birthday off, whether that's a monetary item or not, but so that we get a look at each one of those and have a better concept of what we're approving or not approving.
Yeah, could we move this over till tomorrow and maybe work on that definition and figure out which version we're going to take up?
That would be better. I would beg for a delay, basically, because almost the entire Division of Labor Relations is negotiating with the Marine Unions, and the top three people in the division are out of the state. And I would prefer to have it at least till Monday so that I could get with the staff that's directly responsible. I could have that much time.
And just like that, I support the concept of the bill. I go along with that concept. It's just how we get there that I'm having problems with.
Yeah.
Can I make one further comment? I want it to be very clear that it's my position and the Department of Administration's position that we believe that the legislature has a very specific role, and that is to appropriate, and none of the support for either one of these substitutes should be construed as support for the legislature to be involved in the actual negotiations of contracts, because if we come and say these are the 10 monetary terms for the APEA, we can't have, it's just not productive for you to say that we'll take 8. You know, it's like the entire agreement is either accepted or rejected, or funded or not funded.
Well,
okay.
I wouldn't go along with it. We may not go along with the, we may not bump the terms, but we may bump the dollar amount that then you wouldn't be able to cover some of the fringe benefits or you know, that's why we want to look at it. You've gone out and negotiated in for us. We passed that responsibility to you. We didn't want it anymore, is my understanding.
That's correct.
On the other side of the coin, we retain the right to the dollar amount of your negotiations, and I think it would be important when we look at the breakdown that whether we say up or down, but we may say the heck with the birthdays, you know.
He decked that amount of money. I would like to reiterate, Mr. Chairman, that it has been my experience, and I've been advised by the Department of Law that the legislature has the authority to accept or reject, but not partially fund. It comes to you as a complete negotiated agreement, and if you don't approve the entire agreement, we have no agreement, and the parties can use whatever administrative remedies they have or go back to the table to renegotiate.
I think what the Senator is referring to, though, is that we don't get what the complete dollar value is. If you give X number of dollars and then you give a value in benefits, we don't see the value in benefits, which you come back in your operating budget and ask to have funded. And therefore, we only see the direct line. And I think that's what we're looking for. What really is the total cost of the package as opposed to just the monetary outlay?
And the legislature did give the administration the power to negotiate. And the legislature can take it back in any way, I would imagine. Because we did do it one time ourselves.
What's the pleasure of the committee on this particular bill?
Mr. Chairman, I suggest that we hold it to Monday then, if that's the... And then that would give the senator and the department enough time to give us a definition. And
Monday morning at 9 o'clock, and we'll take it up again.
Monday at 10.
Night.
Member Joseph, you want to take up 287? Terry Elder here to testify.
Mr. Chairman, prior to the time that he testifies, could I ask Senator Joseph a question? Joe, were you going to have a committee substitute on this?
I'm just checking. I wasn't, no.
Okay, so it's still back to the same concept that you had discussed before?
Oh, we had a committee substitute on 251, which was on our calendar yesterday, and which Senator Finks asked to hold over. And that concern that Senator expressed had to do with where the program should be housed, that is, whether it should be in CNRA or somewhere else. And we talked to Mr. Miles today of ASHA, and I have no objection to lodging the program in ASHA if that's the committee's desire.
Now, I have Senate Bill 287 here, and I have a lot of questions. I think this might, if we will hear it, it might be the way to go and may solve your problem, too.
Well, if we could hear the witness.
But then, Mr. Chairman, I don't know about the time. We do have a long calendar today. We have six or seven bills on. I don't know. It's quarter till.
Okay, we can hold it over till tomorrow morning.
Where's 251?
I have it. To look at it, and I was looking at it in relationship with this one, and okay. I don't have any philosophical objections to the bill. I'm looking at, like Senator Josephson said,
they're tied together, though, aren't they? Yeah. Can we bring them up both at the same time?
I suggest we do them Monday, because I will be gone tomorrow. Okay.
Monday. Okay, so Monday. Well, on Senate Bill 233, we had some questions here. Is anyone from D.C. ready to testify? Mm-hmm. Joe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Joe Fladuas. I work for the Department of Environmental Conservation. The Senate Bill 233 is, I think, really non-controversial and straightforward. Six of the seven states eligible to join the Northwest Compact have already joined by legislative action. And I'm just primarily here to answer any questions you might have.
One of the first questions we had when the bill was up last time was who creates the less than the 1 cubic meter of low-level radioactive waste exported by Alaska? I'm told it's University of Alaska, and it's less than 1 cubic yard. And I guess the next thing we need to know is, have DEC or anyone done a comprehensive cost estimate for developing a low-level radioactive waste site in Alaska?
Yes, we have, Mr. Chairman. It's between $1.3 and $2 million per year to maintain a site such as that.
For less than this 1 cubic yard?
Yes, that's why it's very cost-effective for us to join the compact and ship the waste to Hanford, Washington.
I guess the next question is, why isn't it cheaper if that's all we have is less than 1 cubic yard? You pay the freight and let one of the other six states take it, as opposed to contaminating our state with such a small quantity.
The federal legislation that set up these compacts in 1980 will prohibit interstate shipment of low-level radioactive waste in 1985. So it appears in 1985 we will not be able to ship it out legally and without being a member of the compact.
So there's a sunset? The federal government is saying you have until 1985 to form a compact or get into a compact, and then there are no more compacts? Okay.
As indicated in one of the handouts that we transmitted earlier, Texas and California have indicated they're not going to join the compact, so it's not clear what's going to happen there.
Mr. Chairman, I have one more question. If we join this compact, what are our responsibilities? What are our responsibilities to our sister states, or what responsibilities are they thinking that we're going to undertake by joining this compact?
We would promulgate regulations, boiler plate, basically. It's similar to what the other states are doing. I don't think that we would have any implied responsibility other than shipping our waste to Hanford, Washington. We calculated that they can take waste until the year 2078 from all the states in the compact, including Alaska, on the 100 acres that they presently have outside of Richland. They also have access to 900 additional acres. So, you know, if they take that, they can take waste in perpetuity, really.
Right now, if we only have a cubic yard, as our chairman says, what happens if we have 5 cubic yards? If something occurs in the state and we all of a sudden generate additional radioactive waste, then what happens?
Ship it out.
Do we have a limit in this compact? You mean they'll take as much as we can give them?
Hanford presently takes 50% of the low-level radioactive waste in the country, and there's restrictions on it. It's approved to take.
Isn't it true, though, if we pass this legislation and we join the compact, that in fact we're subject to having a disposal site in our state?
That's correct.
We could end up the dumping ground for the other 6.
I wanted to know.
That's correct, except as I mentioned, it
let me ask another question, if I might. It seems the University of Alaska is the only entity in the state that comes up with this low-level radioactive waste. How do they generate it, and what necessitates them generating it? Are they involved in a federal contract which causes this? What I'm trying to get at, if we're doing something for a federal grant for $100,000, it's going to cost us $1 million a year to get rid of it, I think we've got a problem, primarily a management problem.
Mr. Chairman, the one of the handouts indicates that low-level radioactive waste is generated by analytical, medical, and research labs, as well as by oil exploration and other industrial activities which use radioisotopes. The most of the radioactive source material used in Alaska is returned to the manufacturer. The University of Alaska generates 1 to 2 cubic meters of waste and contaminated protective clothing that requires disposal.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, the letter says July 1st, 1983 is our deadline, not 1985.
Senator? You indicated affirmatively when Senator Bennett asked you the question, under what conditions could other states, if I'm correct in this, could other states demand that we be a site, a repository site for this material?
I think if Hanford were filled, then they would look to one of the other states in the compact. But as I mentioned, it won't be filled until the 22nd century. I don't think we have to worry about that.
Okay, are there any risks or hazards involved in transporting the 1 cubic yard or the contaminated clothing through Alaska and down to the state of Washington? And which districts transported through.
Good question, but I think, you know, it's shipped up here also. It's shipped up into Alaska besides we want to ship it.
Well, no, but I'm trying to appraise whether I want to have stuff buried in the ground in Ruby or whether I want it brought to the Anchorage International Airport. Can you help me a little bit?
To get it buried in Ruby or anywhere else in Alaska, we would have to set up a mechanism that would cost the state about $1.5 million a year.
But no, just from a health point of view, I'm being facetious, of course, but is there a risk to any population centers in Alaska because we transport this stuff out of state?
No, I don't believe there is. Low-level radioactive.
What is the cost to the state by joining the compact and by having our waste transported out?
Initially, $18,000. For the first year, it would cost about $10,000 to write regulations.
Right, but are there additional costs on this?
That would be to the University of Alaska, I think, for ship.
What is the cost there?
Don't know.
Okay, Mr. Chair, it would be no additional cost because they're shipping there now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any further questions?
What do you want done on this?
Question of the committee. I really don't have any preference.
You've got all the stuff.
Yeah. You get it out of the washer.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Oh my God.
move it out to individual recommendation.
Have a motion for it, committee. Move it out to individual recommendation. Sign the bill. Tomorrow morning, 8:30.
No meeting tomorrow?
Tomorrow morning, 8:30.
Oh, 8:30.
Tomorrow? First item we have up this morning, we take up SCR 9, requesting that Farm Loop Road in the Matsu Pitna Borough be upgraded.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The Farm Loop Road was assumed to be upgraded to 28-foot wide gravel road under this project. So what they're looking for is to upgrade it to a 28-foot wide gravel road all the way. There is a fiscal note with this bill. These costs were, the preliminary engineering will be about $85,000. The right-of-way is $100,000. Utilities, $100,000. And the actual construction is $1.7 million. The costs were assumed to increase at 10% per year through the life of the project. DOTCOS does have this road on its six-year plan. It is number 11. It's kind of far away down the priority list, and I believe the sponsor just wants to encourage DOTCOS to maybe up this road on its priority list and get some work done. DOTCOS stretches out the various stages of the road, and it could take up to 42 months to upgrade this road if DOTCOS proceeds on its usual schedule. And I think that there's no public opposition to upgrading this. The route is already chosen. They can move quickly with the project if they chose to do so. And I would guess that the concurrent resolution is to encourage a quicker action on the road.
Any discussion? If anyone's allowed time to testify on the bill, we have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill out with individual recommendation.
All in favor? SCR 9 moves to committee individual recommendation. Next item to take up this morning, Senate Bill 37, an act relating to state aid for municipalities.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this bill, right now, state aid to municipalities comes under two areas. Would you like me to hand out my handouts, or should we take the testimony? What would you like
maybe,
me to do?
Maybe we should have the handout, and then is there anyone from out of town to testify on this bill? Probably have the handouts. And
okay. This is from beginning work. We did very, very complicated. Council of Mayors met during the interim, and right now, the paperwork for municipal revenue sharing and municipal assistance is double because one of the programs is conducted through CNRA and the other is conducted through the Department of Revenue. And the municipalities spend a lot of time and energy trying to get all the necessary paperwork to qualify for these various payments. And it's been thought for quite a while that these programs needed to be consolidated under one department and under one chapter. And Senate Bill 37 attempts to do that, except that it's not quite in shape yet. There's a lot of questions that people still have. There's some technical opposition to the bill and just outright opposition to the bill, even though everybody likes the concept. The fact that they want municipal revenue sharing and municipal assistance under one bill is beneficial to everyone. What we have on the handout is what's existing right now under Chapters 88, 89, and 90. What Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 37 does, and then the Governor has introduced a bill in the House, House Bill 317, and what it does. So there's a lot of interest in consolidating these programs and making them equal for everyone. In both of these bills, the unincorporated boroughs get some impact funds also, which they don't get now. What I would suggest is we can go over this as a committee. We can take some testimony from the people who are here, and the prime sponsor has requested that we do more work on this bill and hold it until next session.
If I might interject, the people that are here to testify, if they're normally here in Juneau, we can defer because I'm sure after the completion of the work on the bill, it'd be more appropriate to testify on it. I would recommend that, working for the committee, that we return the bill to the bill file for further work and take it up at a later date. All in favor? 37 returns to the bill file.
For the information committee, I was able to talk to Senator Sackett this morning, and he certainly concurred.
Next item we'll take up this morning is Senate Bill 199, an act relating to mortgage assistance members of the Alaska delegation to the United States Congress. Pretty simple bill.
Mr. Chairman, can we have a briefing?
I
would just like to note that anyone who is contemplating running for Congress or U.S. Senate may have a conflict of interest in this.
That's true, man, and I will still vote. The bill is pretty self-explanatory, allowing the members of the Alaska delegation of the U.S. Congress mortgage assistance for our normal program. Is there anyone that's here to testify? No one has signed up. I would move then that the bill be moved from committee with individual recommendations. All in favor? 99, moved from committee, individual recommendations. The next item before us is committee substitute for House Bill 332, an act relating to professional licensing and regulation practice of medicine, extending the termination date to the state medical board, which of course is caught up in the sunset provisions at this time. It's my understanding that unless action is taken, the board is sunsetted on the 30th of June this year. Is there anyone here to testify on the bill? Mr. Yearn?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rick Urien, speaking on behalf of the Alaska State Medical Association. And briefly, we obviously favor this bill, and if you, I don't know what your pleasure is, Mr. Chairman, I can go through it section by section and tell you exactly what it does, but the major changes in this law will allow for the hiring of an investigator under the Department of Commerce, and the big thing for us, of course, is the extension of the sunset provision. It also increases fees for physicians, and other than that, it makes different technical amendments in the way the board operates, and we feel it would be a more efficient operation for the adoption of the bill.
Senator Bates?
Yes, thank you, Senator Bennett. Through the chair, Mr. Urien, is the board in its one-year grace period right now?
So yeah, this
truly
is it.
Well, this is it, just like the site board. Okay, thank you.
Senator Fisher?
One thing I don't remember from Kent is that the fiscal note shows revenues of $549,000 during FY84 and then going down to $17,600 a year. Why is it such a big bulge in 84?
Well, they renew every 4 years, so every 4 years is a biggie, and then there are numerous fees that pick up on the odd years.
Right. Okay.
Do we have further discussion? Do you have a motion? Senators, take your pick.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill with individual recommendations.
Motion for the committee to move committee substitute for House Bill 332, Finance. All in favor? Bill moved from committee, individual recommendations. Any member have anything further to come before the committee this morning? If not,
good meeting, Mr. Chairman.
Very efficient.
Very good meeting. Yay, Mr. Chairman.
This morning, for those of you who are here, on Senate Bill 78, Senate Bill 251, and Senate Bill 287, we'll have to take those up tomorrow morning at 8:30. People of the subcommittee are not able to be with us this morning. We will at this time take up Senate Bill 55, Senator Fisher.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, last time, a desire was expressed to have a definition of monetary terms of an agreement.
Yeah.
And there's a proposed amendment to the bill that would provide the language of such an amendment. I'll give you a moment to read it if you wish, and then I'll add one more point. The department suggested on line 3 before the word appropriation to have read an increased appropriation. It was my feeling that the word increased should not be there, so that the legislature would have an opportunity to review the monetary terms, even if they were to remain the same, because there might be circumstances when the legislature might want to have those reduced rather than kept the same. Deputy Commissioner Elna Andrews of the Administration Department is here if you wish to have testimony on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear from Andrews, because it would almost be hard to conceive of something that would not require an appropriation, even if you had a grievance procedure. Somebody has to process the paperwork. So perhaps we could hear from him.
Ms. Andrews?
Deputy Commissioner of Administration. The Division of Labor Relations worked over the weekend for a definition of monetary terms that would be broad enough to cover most things that we can identify a cost when we're costing out a labor contract. Very often we will cost out an item down to a tenth of a percent or anything that we can get some identifiable numbers on and include in the overall monetary package. The suggestion that I sent over this morning was changed a little bit, and I'm just now reviewing it, so I'm not quite sure. Monetary terms of agreement means those changes that will require an appropriation for implementation. If that's how Senator Fisher is proposing it, then I don't have any difficulty. I think it would be a mistake to construe this language to mean that if the legislature had appropriated a 5% pay increase for fiscal year 83, then the pay bill came for fiscal year 84, and you wanted to appropriate less than what it would take to carry on what was in effect for fiscal year 83, and also not fund the increase, then you would be taking away a prior appropriation, which would basically nullify the agreement that we had reached. And I don't know if that's your intent.
Well, Chairman, that was certainly not the intention. This was simply to follow through on the basic concept of having the legislature given the opportunity to look at the proposed contract. It wouldn't affect any previous appropriations.
If I'm reading it so that it's talking about the changes going forward and identifying all of those things that will either require an appropriation, a change in revenues, or a reduction in work hours, productive work hours, then we're in agreement. And the section where it says resulting change revenues could apply to the example where if we have 1,000 people working in the ferry system and 500 of them have the ability to take their car once a year free, we'd look at the experience from prior years and say that 50% of them did and the loss in revenue to the state was so much, and that would be an offsetting cost to the contract.
Senator Fakes?
But, Mr. Chairman, to follow up on what Senator Fisher said, if we are interested in all those terms and conditions of employment, all the terms and conditions of employment that result in some kind of appropriation or loss of appropriation or whatever, then we'd have to take out the word changes in the. If we were interested, the legislature was looking at all the monetary terms of an agreement, then this particular one would read, and I'm just throwing this out for discussion. Monetary terms of an agreement means those terms or conditions of employment resulting from an agreement that will require an appropriation, et cetera. The section as it reads says those changes. I'm just talking about if we eliminate the word changes, if we eliminate changes in need, then we're looking at the whole contract, exactly what the cost of that contract is.
Well, we're not supposed to.
Except that we've already got a contract that's been agreed to in prior years and appropriated. You can't. Wait, excuse me, if I may continue just a second. I'm getting some information here. So when you negotiate a contract, do you start over from the beginning, or do you just assume that things that were worked out the previous year, you don't work out again?
Do it both ways.
That's what I thought. I thought they did it both ways, and that's why I kind of wanted wanted to be able to see all of them.
Sure, Joseph.
There is already, in effect, a contract at any given point, and that's the starting place. And presumably, if the workers agreed to carry on without a contract or extend the existing contract from year to year, that could be done, and nobody would, I don't think anybody would suggest, unless there was a time of real hardship, that we should go back and renegotiate the status quo. What happens, though, is what the legislature focuses on are changes in the status quo. I mean, this is a matter of... I'm a little troubled by the idea that we might go back and go pierce into the existing structure to have a report on every item of cost, including the status quo. For one thing, we would lose focus on what the proposed contract impact. So where are we with that, Eleanor, under the language?
My understanding is, and what I'm in support of, is the language says those changes in the terms and conditions, because we're asking the legislature, when we come forward, to fund increases, because we've already agreed to in prior years, and you've already funded the existing contract, and to go back and say this is the cost of doing business 8 hours a day.
Well, now,
and have that as a monetary term to be appropriate when it's already in existence.
Now, if you didn't have the words, those changes, then everything would be... And then we get the legislature in the executive function, it seems to me, because our control is in the fiscal control, in the appropriation factor. But if everything... I can't conceive of anything in an agreement that would not be considered a monetary term if we took out the words, those changes.
The only way I would see this as being workable or acceptable would be with the language, those changes in this amendment.
Any further discussion? Thank you, Alan. Senator Fisher?
Mr. Chairman, if there's no further discussion, I'll move the adoption of this amendment with one minor change in the second line right in the beginning, change it to read terms and conditions.
Motion before the committee. All in favor for adoption of the amendment? Amendment adopted. Do we have any further discussion? Do we have another motion?
Well, I was just going to move the bill, including the amendment, as a finding of CS, and move it out with individual recommendations.
All in favor of the motion? May I substitute for Senate Bill?
Mr. Chairman, there's a problem. We had two bills that we were looking at, two alternatives, version one and version two. And I'm not sure we ever decided which version we would go for.
I'll rescind my motion.
Senator Mulcahy, did you want to move version, was it two?
Mr. Chairman, I am personally still supportive of the positive one, which would be version one. I don't know how the rest of the committee...
Okay. Do you want to move for a motion adoption of version one?
Mr. Chairman, I would... move the adoption of version one with the finance committee substituted, including the amendment that was just that individual recommendation.
All in favor?
On the question of version one versus version two, the thing about version one that I have some concern about is that you could have a situation where, say, the Senate, in its wisdom, passes a concurrent resolution on the 20th day by a vote of 19-1, and the House does not act by the 60th day, even though there may be broad support. It may become a leadership question. It may become some type of
bargaining thing. The failure of the second house to pass the consent resolution within 60 days could require the parties to resume negotiations, and the parties are happy, the governor's happy, one of the bodies of the legislature is affirmatively happy, and B, it could also be a matter of just calendaring or the slow rolling by one committee. I'm just saying these things for discussion, and I'm not sure. I wanted to think it through. But those considerations seem to me to argue for version two, that if the legislature doesn't care enough to affirmatively adopt a concurrent resolution within the 60-day period, then the monetary terms are considered acceptable. The appropriation power still, as I understand it, rests with the legislature anyway, but at least the parties aren't sent back for more negotiation. Particularly, Mr. Chairman, because if we send them back for negotiation without any guidance, and they've already reached an agreement, there's a difficulty there. So I think version two would send them back less often for further negotiation without guidance.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor it, but I'd like to see it move forward because I go with the concept that's in there, but I think that we can take the senator's arguments and flip them right around the other way and have the same situation. If we're going at it in a negative way in fact not approve them by no action, and that could be held up as so that I have problems with a negative action being a positive indication that by doing nothing on either side, we're sending forth a signal that we are in agreement. And although I certainly understand how it could get it held up in the process.
And ultimately end up as a court verdict, and we'd end up having to pay vis-a-vis the court. Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bennett. I think version one, I hear what you're saying, and I think both of them can get solved. I think version one would require more people to be up front with their motives. I think because something would have to be passed, that would bring it more to the public arena. Versus just letting it, people could have various agendas and just let it not do anything and let the agreement go forward then. So I think I'm going to support version one, the Finance Committee, yes, simply because I think in my mind it's going to require more upfront action and less backdoor action.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor it either, but I just, if I were Eleanor Andrews, who kindly left the room. And I was in a situation where this, and I might not care about this so much except for the events of the last 2 weeks, which made me wonder about the bicameral.
Thank God for it.
But and if I were in a situation where I was the state negotiator and the Senate had, maybe by unanimous consent, passed this concurrent resolution and sent it to the House, now it's March, and I'm Eleanor Andrews, and who's back in the room. And I know the Senate has said, great, it's fine, we approve the monetary terms. And I see the House has not acted, or vice versa. Then the 60th day comes and goes, and I don't have my concurrent resolution. I'm sent back to the bargaining table. I don't have the foggiest idea. The legislature has still not told me what it will approve. And I don't know where I start with the employees, and do I say to them, well, we got to reduce this by 2% or 3% or cut down the travel or change the hours of employment, or I don't know, I don't have any guidance like that. I think that's a miserable position to put somebody in.
In the 11th legislature, something not too dissimilar happened, and the governor called a special session, and it was resolved. Boom.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, so the issue of acting, the negative action having a positive result, there are two constitutionally provided issues where the legislature, by inaction, confirms something done by the executive branch. One is executive orders on reorganization of the executive branch, The second is decisions of the Local Government Boundary Commission go into effect if nothing is approved. So there is precedent already for doing this that way. I just thought I'd raise that point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with the so-called, if in fact inversion one body or the other passed it, it could still be held up by the other body, going either way, and then you would end up with the legislature doing nothing, and then the inference would be there, so that it's a catch-22. It's a concept I go along with, it's a concept I agree with, but the system being what the system is, that either one could get held up by the other body, and even conceivably, if there was no strong feeling in the committee.
Chairman, if there is an affirmative resolution, however, usually there would be preambles that would indicate where the dissatisfaction is, and it would be guidance to the government. If it's negative, then there is no guidance, and I think that's fine. We've had a fair debate.
Good Monday. Senator McCain, you want to restate your motion?
Mr. Chairman, again, I would move for the version number one to include the amendment for a finance committee to substitute individual recommendation.
All in favor of the motion? Motion carries. Do we have another motion? One Senator Ray's been looking for?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill from committee with individual recommendation.
All in favor? Move the bill, individual recommendation. Move from committee, individual recommendation. Anything further come before the committee?
Mr. Chairman, what's Senator Ray going to complain about today? We moved this bill.
It'll be tough, but I'm sure it'll be 8:30 tomorrow morning. We do have a backlog of bills because of the...